This episode was recorded for my UK Column show. Please support UK Column by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
It's been a while, and the first time on my UK Column show, Dave Curtin, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you. Really good to be with you again, Germ, on your new show.
Dave, I was thinking earlier, before you and I started chatting, that you're probably one of the most uplifting guests like I've ever had on my show. Like, we could talk about a nuclear winter and the whole world dying around us. And after you and I've chatted, I'd still like to go and play a game of tennis afterwards.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope that doesn't happen. But if it does, you just got to try and, get yourself through everything, don't you? I mean, there's so much rubbish happening all over the place. But the thing is that, there's two things that lift my spirits as well. The one is that we're fighting. There's so many good people fighting back. And I think, since the craziness of 2020 with all the lockdowns and stuff, it's like I lost a huge number of friends, but I found some new friends. I found a new group of people that are, that are fighting together, and we're on the same side, and we realize what's going on, and we want to make the world a better place. I mean, I'm not into creating a whole new world, a whole new system, but just, making a better place where we are. And of course, the second thing, as you know, is my faith. I'm a Christian. I'm very open about that. And that always helps as well. So that's fantastic too. Yeah, I do. And, I'm so blessed to be the leader of the Heritage Party in the UK, because that gives me amazing purpose. It was very disappointing in 2021 when I was on the London Assembly. I stood for re-election. I didn't get back on, so I lost my position there. But I've got a new position, and I'm trying to create this and build this, and there's a lot of people who have joined. And, yeah, I have purpose in trying to fight the insanity. And I've spoken at length and many times in different places about cultural Marxism, globalism, Agenda 2030, all of the things and how they're interconnected, all of these things that are trying to decline and decay and demolish society. But I wake up thinking, well, today I want to be productive. I don't always think that, but I get up in the mornings and I pray, God, help me be productive today and do something good. And he does. And like today, I'm talking to you. And before I came on your show to record this, I did another interview with another gentleman who lives in a town in the south of England where they're fighting a migrant, not a hotel, but a migrant centre being set up in their town, which is going to be full of military-aged men. So I've done a lot today already. And I know people won't know this, but for me, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, so it's I'm looking forward to doing more things in the day. Everything I do, it gives me a sense of purpose, and I hope that radiates out, and other people can catch that too, and they do, and it's great to see that.
Just very quickly, the Heritage Party. Now, I'm not British, so you'll have to give me a quick refresher. This is how you and I met. I think you gave, what was it, a presentation? You spoke at some political event or in, I don't know where it was. It was years ago and I can't remember.
The first time you interviewed me, it was ages ago. It was like four years ago or something. And I think I was still on the London Assembly then. And
I think that's what it was. Yeah, I think that's what it was. And there was something that you said that really resonated with me, which is why I contacted you. But just very quickly then. Okay, so the Heritage Party, what is it?
So it's a socially conservative party in the UK because there wasn't one. And I set it up in 2020 because I thought the UK needs a properly socially conservative party with good principles that we can hang our policies on. So we're for national sovereignty because I was in the fight for Brexit for many years beforehand. But we stand for traditional family values, a culture of life. We're a pro-life party, financial responsibility in government, self-sufficiency in skills, self self-sufficiency in energy. So we're against all of this net zero nonsense, and we're against wokery and all this rubbish that is coming, that is bringing in, you know, this identity politics, which is completely destructive because it pits different groups against each other. I mean, this is basically the cultural Marxism, which has been, you know, building since the 1920s, if you go back in history, but is actually, really coming to the front now and being very destructive in what it does in politics. And, you know, many other positive principles, equality before the law, you know, and now in the UK, we've got this two-tier policing, two-tier justice. Everybody hates it. But all the main parties, which I call the Uni Party, are for all of this nonsense, which is destructive to our nation. So I set the Heritage Party up in 2020. So it's been going 5 years now. And it's tough to break through in the first past the post electoral system that we have. But I think we're very respected as a party that puts forward proper socially conservative principles and that are very sensible, and we've been consistent and coherent over 5 years, and we speak from principles even when they're unpopular until they become popular, and then we talk about them more. So that's the Heritage Party and what we stand for, and we have a few councillors at the town and parish level, which is great. That's what we can do, and we're just building as much as we can. So that's where we are.
I was at friends last night, and I don't know, 15 people or whatever, and the host decided to play a video of some of the stuff that's been going on for the last 5 years, you know, from Agenda 2030 to sustainable development to transhumanism and to mRNA, nanotech, etc. And most of the people sitting there were just normies and were looking at this going, this doesn't work for me. And I was just wondering whether something like what you're doing, I don't mean to throw water on the fire, but do you think it's just a continuous losing battle, or do you have a sense of optimism or hope that there will be some sort of critical mass at some point?
Well, I say that the battle is tough. And, you don't always win all of the battles. The war is tough, I would say. You know, you fight different battles every day and at different places, different things at different times. You don't always win every single battle, but we're in a war, and we know that the end of it, you know, if you have faith in God, you know that at the end, Jesus wins. So, you know, the end is there. So we just got to, you know, walk in that, you know, and a lot of people understand that this is a spiritual battle as well as a political battle and a cultural battle and a social battle. So, you know, when you know that, I just go and I take part and I participate. And, you know, not all the characters in the Bible won. Not, you know, some of them came to a bad end, like Jeremiah, but he still was faithful into what he had to do and the mission that he had. But yeah, it is tough. And, you know, you mentioned sitting around in a party in a room with a lot of normies. And I suppose I don't mix so much with normies because, you know, I'm leading the Heritage Party. So the people I talk to and I'm in communication with are people that are sort of on the same wavelength as I am, who understand what's going on to one level or another. But yeah, when I do, it's like, well, you know, what's going on here? Because for normies, they're interested in the football match or what's on telly or, you know, the latest pop record or the latest, you know, what was on the mainstream media. But even some of them are now understanding that, you know, there's a lot of people who are dying and injured because of these injections. You know, it's been 4 years since they were rolled out in the UK, 5 years actually. And, they jumped on this hook, line and sinker in 2020 and now realize that something isn't quite right. And now they're trying to roll out this digital ID as well, which is another thing. And because Keir Starmer is doing it and he's doing it in such a ham-fisted way, such a tyrannical, totalitarian messaging behind it. It's like, you will have this, and if you don't have it, you won't be able to get a job, and if you don't have it, you won't be able to rent a house, and if you don't have it, you're going to get fined. A lot of people are just, you know, appalled by that and actually repelled into realizing that actually, well, this is bad. We need to stand against this because this is taking away our freedoms. So in some small ways, normies, I wouldn't say waking up, I don't use that sort of phraseology anymore, but are beginning to understand that the things are not quite right. And I think, you know, maybe here in the UK, there's a lot of different things happening, and they're really trying to push the agenda here. And there's more of a backlash against it than I think the people who are globalists have envisaged. So there is a lot of reaction against what is happening. So I wouldn't say people are totally awake, if you like, but some people are understanding there's something wrong, and they need to do something about it.
Would you go back to 2019?
No, I don't think I would, because 2019 wasn't a good year, you know? I mean, but in the UK, the whole period between 2016 and 2020 was the period between the referendum to leave the EU and actually coming out of the EU finally 4.5 years later. And it was a horrendous time. I mean, politics was falling apart. There was, you know, people were fighting each other about Brexit. It wasn't a good time. And I think because we had that issue in the UK uniquely, which you didn't have in South Africa, you didn't have in the EU or Australia. I think, you know, I don't look back at 2019 and think that was a good year. But I think, you know, the sort of thing in the question there is that, you know, the period since 2020 has been absolutely horrendous. Of course it has. But I've made so many new friends. I've learned so much. I've become much more aware of, you know, the things that are going on in the world, through the horrible things that have happened. And I wouldn't want those things to happen again. But even though they have happened, I've learned so much. And I've done things, you know, I started the Heritage Party, of course, and I am where I am now. And if that hadn't have happened, I would be a different person to some extent. I wouldn't know what I know now. I wouldn't have done what I've done. I wouldn't have had the experiences that I have. And, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm happy in myself, in my soul. I have nothing to compare it to if that hadn't have happened. And we'd, you know, just gone on. And if today was just, you know, nothing had changed since 2019. So the answer is no. I wouldn't go back to 2019. I would still live through everything that's happened now, but because I've learned so much.
Yeah, that's exactly my thinking also. I wouldn't go back to 2019 because I feel a lot more enlightened now. The problem, Dave, is that ignorance is bliss, and when you see stuff like we've seen over the last few years, you can't unsee it, and it's not very blissful.
No. There are things, I know there are things that are, you know, happening that I really don't want to, you know, go down the rabbit holes to look at them, because I don't want to find out what's there, you know. I mean, I know all about COVID, about digital ID, about Agenda 2030, about the World Economic Forum, about stakeholder capitalism, all of these kind of things. But you get people, you know, they talk about these dumbs, deep underground military bases and what might be going on there. It's something that I'm aware of, but I don't really want to look, you know, where if there's something there or not that is way deeper and way more horrific than even the things that I know now. So, you know, I take on board your point. I've learned some things about the things that I need to know about for now, but there's some other things that, well, you know, I would rather just, you know, not know about that if that's true. You know, I, of course, you know, with the Epstein files and the you know, the paedophilia, the child trafficking, and, you know, what do they call these things? Frazzle drip and adrenochrome, all of this kind of stuff. I mean, just the thought of it is utterly horrific. So, ignorance is bliss. I'm aware that there's horrible stuff going on there, but I don't really want to know about it. I don't need to know about it for what I'm doing. People who do know about it and are fighting it, you know, they are... That can injure your soul so much if you hear about these things and you actually, you know, see what's going on. So in a way, it's like, well, you know, maybe I should have the courage to go and look at those things and bring them to the surface and fight against those things. But, you know, we'll see. I can't say that I have, you know, I say that and I think, well, you know... It's not very good. It's not a very good show that I'm sitting here saying that I know these things exist, but I'm not doing anything about it. But I'm fighting so much in the political sphere in the UK, you know, so ignorance is bliss of those things, but we need to deal with them eventually.
I wrote a Substack a few days ago in which I was talking about my sort of first and second Damascus moments. Excuse me, those Red Pill moments. And I think my first was around 2009. Hang on. I swallowed something. Anyway, when was your first Damascus moment?
I was just minding my own business, really, as a teacher. Before I got into politics, I was a chemistry teacher. I taught a little bit in England, and then I taught in schools around the world. I was just having a good time, you know. I mean, I'd always been interested in culture and politics and society and you know, maybe at some point getting involved in politics, but the doors never seemed to open to me. But, you know, I had a friend, actually, who was a flatmate for a while, and he just spoke to me about Alex Jones and what he was talking about. This was a long time ago. This was 15 years ago. And I started looking into it and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, there's stuff going on there that is very interesting. And maybe the way things are presented to us on the mainstream media is not quite how they are. And so, you know, I looked into this a lot, and then I started looking into cultural Marxism, which was one of the first things I looked into. You know, it's gone, you know, grown since then. I've just become more and more aware of things as I need to become aware of them. And so this is something that's a process, I think, of learning that started about 15 years ago, through chatting to somebody who already knew about stuff and who just informed me of some new things. And I think, you know, having a background in science, you're curious, you know, and I don't discount anything. If someone tells me something, I'll investigate it. You know, a lot of things that people tell me are rubbish, but some things people tell me are like, oh, that's interesting. I think I'll have a look at that. And then, you know, when it's then juxtaposed with the mainstream media aggressively trying to ridicule and silence and cancel anyone who has a different opinion, I think, whoa, that's interesting. Why are you not open to this? Why are you trying to cancel this person or that person or this idea and that idea? Surely we can talk about ideas without you ridiculing them on and just instigating a huge number of ad hominem attacks on the people who are bringing new ideas. And that made me even more curious about the things I was reading into and finding out about. So, and now, you know, it's not just me. You know, when I started speaking about cultural Marxism and doing, you know, lectures and speeches on it in 2017, I think I was a lone voice on it. But now there's like hundreds of people talking about it. And it's like, you know, this is something that people are really awake to now, you know, not just me, but, you know, 5, 10, 20% of the population. So the number of people who are aware are growing. But I think for me, it started, you know, with a conversation with a flatmate, you know, 15 years ago. And I've just learned grown in my knowledge since then.
When you talk about cultural Marxism, what are you talking about?
Well, what I mean is Marxism translated into, not from economic terms into cultural terms, whereby certain groups are persuaded that they are victim groups. You know, Marxism tries to inculcate class consciousness in the workers, so they will be dissatisfied with society and rise up and fight the bourgeoisie, take control of the capital and collectivize it among themselves. Well, that's been translated into cultural terms. So women are made to feel like they're victims of men. So women are oppressed, men are the oppressors. Gays are oppressed, the homo, heterosexual Christian society is oppressive. You know, black people are oppressed, white people are the oppressors. And then you get these whole academic corpuses of literature and courses to do with critical race theory, critical gender theory, that say society is systematically and intrinsically racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, all of these things. And all of these groups then need to come together to fight intersectional oppression and basically ruin everything that's good, you know. So it's basically a cultural movement to make everybody hate white Christian society, if you like. You know, I say white in terms of culture, you know. So and that's cultural Marxism, and it's very, very oppressive, and you see it manifest today in the attack on free speech, where anybody who says something that is not of the far left is called a name, and then they try to cancel you or even drag you through the courts and get you imprisoned. So it's very, very damaging and very, very dangerous. So basically, it is a collection of oppressor victim narratives based on cultural groups rather than economic groups. That's what cultural Marxism is.
Why, though? Why do you think there are people that attach themselves to that?
Well, originally, of course, Marx lived in the 19th century, and then after he died, you had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917, the October Revolution, which was quick and violent and aggressive and oppressive, and the working class was in grinding poverty. So they could be very easily manipulated to think that they're oppressed, and if they rise up and, you know, they kill the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas, and they take control of the power, that they would then be living in a utopia. And of course, when it happened, they found out that they weren't in a utopia, and they just became just as oppressed as everybody else. It didn't work. These violent, aggressive revolutions that happened in the East didn't work in the West. They were tried, you know, communists tried revolutions in Germany and Austria and Hungary, Bavaria, you know, even the UK, even England. It didn't take off at all in England, but there were revolutions that took power for a few weeks or a few months in Austria, Hungary, but they didn't work. They didn't hold because the working class was patriotic and they didn't like this, you know, communist revolutionaries taking over control of their country and changing society in a way that they didn't want, you know, in imposing totalitarian control. So communism, violent communist revolutions didn't happen in the West or Western and Central Europe in the 1910s and 1920s. So then the people that wanted to inculcate global communism, global Marxism, changed strategy in the West. So they changed the focus of praxis from, as Gramsci says, from the economic substructure to the cultural superstructure. So then they just converted, you know, the idea of oppressor victim narratives, which worked economically in Russia, into cultural oppressor victim narratives in order to try to undermine all of the values of Western society. And over, you know, 100 years or so of the long march through the institutions, they've actually managed to capture first universities and then media companies and then political parties and now even businesses to actually become Marxist, if you like, and to stop acting in a normal way. You know, when you get businesses who decide, well, the purpose of our existence is not to make a profit. The purpose of our existence is to impose environmental, social and governance rules on the people who work for us and the people who are our customers. They've been infiltrated and captured by Marxist ideology. They're no longer working on terms of common sense. They will actually destroy themselves in the process, but they think that they're doing good. They think that they are virtuous by imposing the DEI agenda, the diversity, equality and inclusion agenda, because that's nice and that is fighting oppression, when actually, you know, in the long run, everyone is going to be poor and oppressed if they carry on down that road. So it's self-defeating, but this is what it is, and this is why some people do it.
I don't know if I'm just imagining things, but it does appear to me, Dave, that a lot of that stuff seems to be very much less active now in the last year or so. Have you noticed that?
Yes, and that's coming directly from America, I think, because you got President Trump in as the president. You know, under 4 years of Biden, all of the cultural Marxist stuff, you know, had a free platform. That was elevated, the DEI agenda, the ESG agenda, you know, all the wokery. That was celebrated, and if you didn't jump on board and celebrate and affirm that, you were cancelled yourself. But I think in the United States, because it is the most powerful country in the largest country by population in the West, that really is having an effect. You know, obviously culture, a lot of the culture that, you know, disseminates around the world comes from the United States. And now President Trump has basically abandoned transgenderism. He's abandoned the immigration, mass immigration. He's actually fighting mass immigration. He's trying to control America's borders. He's against all of the net zero stuff, which goes against it with the ESG system for businesses, environmental, social and governance modeling that comes from the World Economic Forum. So that's really having an impact. And I think in some countries in Europe as well, they're abandoning that. There's less of it happening in the EU and EU countries. And I think in the UK, we're in a very bizarre situation because we got an extremely Marxist, culturally Marxist government, but there's a massive pushback against it from the population of the country that doesn't want this anymore, that is actually just completely sick of LGBT diversity weeks and Black Lives Matter weeks and Extinction Rebellion weeks and months and all of this stuff. And so, yes, I'm very hopeful because I think people have just, they're just fed up of it. And, you know, there was in the last week or so, there's been a lot of talk in the UK media about should there be so much advertising on television which portrays Britain as essentially being a migrant country. You know, 16% of the UK's population is non-white, Black and Asian, you know, wherever, you know, Middle Eastern, Indian. But they sort of take up about 80% of all of the people on television advertising because they're trying to portray Britain as being a country that's mostly populated by Black and Asian people, and also saying that they always have been. That actually people are rewriting history in history books to suggest, oh, the Vikings were Black, you know, the Saxons were Black. And everyone is just, this is nonsense. So I think people are just, they hate it, and they just, it's come to the point where it's just so ridiculous. People are just like, I'm done with this, you know, I'm completely done with it.
You know what was an absolute pleasure? I was in China a few weeks ago, and sure, lots and lots of things to criticize, but lots of things also to learn from. And I'll tell you what, I didn't see any LGBTQ in any of the 9 cities that I went to. No greenhead lesbians, no anything to do with that sort of cultural Marxist nonsense that you were referring to. It was such a pleasure.
Fantastic. Yeah, I know. You know, when in some areas, China and Russia are morally superior to the West. You know, they look at the West in horror and think, what the hell are you doing to your boys and girls that you're mutilating them? And I don't think that China and Russia mutilate their children. How on earth has that happened in the West? So, you know, there's a lot to criticize about China in certain aspects, but that, I totally agree with you. They're not going to have anything to do with it. And you see pictures, you know, I taught before I was, you know, in politics, and I taught at international schools. And the Chinese children are absolutely brilliant at maths and science and logic. You know, they're just a world streets ahead of anyone in the West. You know, they know at 14 what children in England are studying at 18. You know, it's amazing. So they really are focused on excellence in education, whereas a lot of people in, you know, schools in the UK are focused on diversity, which is, you know, in China just laughs at the stupidity of what's going on. You know, and they're quite right to.
If you just leave people alone, they will be diverse.
Yeah, you absolutely agree with you. You know, and this is if you just left people to be on, you know, do what they want to do, I think more people will be more well adjusted than if you're trying to force people to go in this direction. But the diversity that they're trying to impose is a fake diversity, because it's like everyone has to affirm LGBT, everyone has to affirm feminist ideology, everyone has to affirm Black Lives Matter ideology. There is no room for anyone to divert or to be diverse and say anything out of this very, very narrow, thin Overton window, which is constructed of identity politics. True diversity is that you have different people with different skills and different interests and different talents. So some people will be interested in maths, some in music, some in sports, some in woodwork, some in, you know, making clothes, some in, you know, caring for people, some in being a nurse. You know, it's a diversity of skills and talents and interests, not a diversity of what you do with your bits, which seems to be what they're doing in the UK.
In actual fact, they've ruined the word diversity, because you and I are diverse by virtue of the fact that we are two different people. You can have a room of 20 Chinese people. That's already diverse, because each one of those 20 is different.
So you'd have loads of different people, or they all look different, but they all think the same. And that's what the cultural Marxist idea of diversity is, which is not diversity. Yeah, it's exactly what you say. Different people with different interests.
And also, they argue diversity is our strength or whatever. And that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, the fake diversity is not a strength. They say that's a political slogan, because you have politicians in the UK and other places who are trying to deliberately make the country what they call hyper-diverse. So they actually want to reduce the white population to below 50% so that they will be a minority. But this is not being imposed on any other countries outside the West. No one is saying to China, oh, you should have a minority of Chinese people. No one's saying to Nigeria, oh, you should have a minority of black people. You should take in migrants from India and Saudi Arabia to make yourselves more diverse. It's only European, North American countries and Australia. It's only happening there.
That's the Kalergi plan. You've heard of that, eh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a plan or an assumption, but it's certainly...
Or an agenda or... But I mean, look, another way of looking at it is replacement theory, but it's just a conspiracy theory, Dave, so we can't talk about it.
Even though it's on the UN website, and they're replaced with migration, yeah. Conspiracy theory by the UN, published in the year 2000.
But why do you think that might be the case then?
For some people, they're just looking at it in terms of bean counting. They think, well, in terms of supporting pensioners, keeping the pension scheme going, they say, well, there's not enough. The birth rate is declining in the West, so we need to bring lots of migrants in so there's enough young people to support pensioners in their old age. Well, that's what they say anyway. Well, I don't think anyone actually cares about, you know, pensioners, white pensioners, when they're supporting replacement migration. But I think a lot of it is there are people, globalists and so on, who deliberately want to destroy the West for some reason. You know, they hate the Western society. I think part of it is because the West has been very, very successful, full of really good people, and has been a powerhouse of, you know, innovation and goodness. It's also, you know, historically been the center of Christianity. And I think that the people who want to bring in a secular world order or a Talmudic world order want to destroy Christianity, and they need to destroy the West, the Western countries, to do that and to completely change them so that they will not be nations anymore. You say, I see there's a difference between a nation and a state, because a nation has a connection to its past and its future through, you know, your children of your forefathers and your descendants will inhabit your land. Where a state could be anything. It doesn't matter who's there. It's just, you know, random atomized people who are paying taxes and consuming products. And so the globalists want to turn our nations into states with atomized individuals who've got no connection to the past or the future or anybody else apart from global corporations, which they interact with on their smartphones. That's what they want to do.
You very sneakily dropped in the word Talmudic. How dangerous do you think Zionism is to sort of Western Christian culture?
I think it's very, very dangerous. And since the 1930s, people have invented this word, Judeo-Christian.
Yes.
You know, well, that was,
it doesn't mean anything.
It's a polemic. No, there is, before the 1930s, no one ever used that term. I mean, it was invented mainly promoted in the United States as a polemic against Hitler. It was to get Christians and Jews together with a common enemy. I think they were actually wrong on that. Now, you know, even Jewish people say, well, the Judeo-Christian is not correct. There's Judaism, which is in many ways the exact opposite of Christianity, because the Talmud, it says horrible, blasphemous, disgusting things about Jesus. It says Mary is a whore. It says Jesus was a sorcerer. It doesn't accept that Jesus was the Messiah. And they're looking
it also says that Jesus is boiling in human excrement.
Exactly. That's what it says about Jesus now, you know, whereas the Bible, the New Testament, obviously, is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Jesus is king. Jesus is glorified. He died and he rose again to save us from our sins. And now he's ascended and he's sitting in heaven at the right hand of the Father. So the Talmud is the exact opposite of the Bible. And so Judaism is the exact opposite of Christianity. There's been so much propaganda and brainwashing of a lot of Christians to believe, oh, you know, Judaism and Christianity, they're very, very similar. We believe the same things. We're just slightly different on these points. But no, it's the exact opposite. And so there is no such thing as Judeo-Christian Christianity. And the Talmud is horrendous and is horrible. And in the Talmud, you have the Noahide laws come out of that, which are actually written into law in the United States, which sound a little bit like the Ten Commandments, but they're seen through the prism of the Talmud, in which all Christians are idolatrous because we worship Jesus as God, and therefore the penalty for that is decapitation. People don't realize that. The Talmud wants to decapitate Christians. That's part of the Noahide laws. And maybe I sound very strong in saying that, and people might go, what are you saying? Go and have a look. Look it up for yourself, and you'll find out that it's true.
The biggest issue with Zionism is not Jews. It's evangelical Christians.
Oh, I think it's both, but there are so many more evangelical Christians that's what I'm saying. United States.
Like, imagine. Yeah, I mean, imagine if there was no such thing as an evangelical Christian.
Well, the thing is, I would say I'm an evangelical Christian, and I would say that Zionism is a perversion of Christianity. I mean, I'm evangelical in the sense that I think the five solas are a good basis of faith.
I'm just jumping in here, but let me just clarify. When I refer to evangelical Christian, I mean that sort of Zionist Christian that believes in Judeo Christianity, and they'll have those Israeli flags up, you know, in the church, while in America.
No, you're right. You're right. And it, you know, if I could just sort of explain that is it. So, I went to a church when I was younger that was evangelical, and they had Israeli flags behind the band, and I never even questioned it. I just thought, oh well, this is what they do because we're Christians. We support the Jews and we support Israel, and it was just assumed, you know. It's only recently I've started questioning it more, and I really started questioning this when someone I know who was on a lot of the freedom marches was arrested and imprisoned at the request of a Jewish NGO because she'd written some tweets about this. You maybe remember Grenfell Tower, this big tower in London that burned down. It was like the Towering Inferno in 2017. Her, you know, it was all over. People were watching this around the world. And she said that was a Jewish, the Jews made this happen. It was a Jewish sacrifice. She'd written some tweets about that in 2017. Everyone had sort of forgotten them. But then some Jewish NGOs went trawling through all of her, you know, past tweets and responses and said, she's anti-Semitic. She was stirring up hatred. They asked the police to arrest her. They did arrest her. They charged her. They brought her through the courts, and she was sentenced to 11 months in prison. So when some Jewish NGOs activists got someone I know put in prison just for some tweets, I just thought, what on earth is this? These people are not what I've been brought up to believe they are through the evangelical churches that I went to. And, you know, I still consider myself evangelical in the sense that the five solas that come from Luther and Calvin and other people are a good description of the Christian faith. You know, sola scriptura, sola gratia, sola fide, solus Christus, soli Deo gloria. You know, those are the five solas if you know what they are.
But sounds Catholic.
It's Latin. So,
right.
You know, so, yeah, that's it. It does, because the Catholics use Latin a lot. They have the Latin Mass. True, it does. I guess back in the 15th century, you know, everyone would have spoken Latin and written in Latin. Anything that was a theological work would have been written in Latin. That's changed since the Reformation, because then people have started to use German and English a lot more. And, you know, and then Bible is now translated to like every language in the world. But yeah, before it was either Latin or Greek, and that was it. But yeah, with evangelical Christianity from the 19th century, see, it started in the 16th century, but in the 19th century, you had John Nelson Darby, who started to construct this whole fake theology of dispensationalism, you know, end times theology. And then the Scofield Study Bible came later in 1909 and built on that, and then put some heresies in the notes of his study Bible. And still today, I hear pastors and preachers making, you know, sermons based on the notes that Scofield wrote, which are heretical, rather than on the text of the Bible itself. And so when they mistranslate the Bible to say this is a common one, those who bless Israel will be blessed, those who curse Israel will be cursed. It doesn't say that in the Bible at all. That's a complete, you know, heresy and a perversion of Scripture. It doesn't even say that. It's about, you know, Genesis 12:3, it's about Abraham. Those who bless Abraham will be blessed, and his seed, which is Jesus, not the 1948 Rothschild State of Israel, that is fake Israel. They've appropriated the name. They don't deserve the name.
Yeah, you're echoing exactly my experience. And it seems like an uphill battle, because the response I get is, well, read your Bible. Yes, that's what I've just done.
Exactly, yes. They need and to read also, the Bible, yes.
And also, Israel today is not the same as Israel in biblical times.
Indeed, in the Bible, in the New Testament, Galatians mentions the Israel of God, which is the church. He even says that he is a true Jew who is one inwardly, not who is one outwardly, who's been circumcised, but someone who's been circumcised in their heart, i.e. who's given their life to Jesus and follows Jesus. So that's what the New Testament says. And the dispensationalists and Christian Zionists studiously ignore the dozens of verses in the New Testament that say there is no longer a Greek nor Jew. We are all one in Christ. That's in almost every epistle. They ignore all of that stuff and just go back and misquote some things in the Old Testament through the Scofield Bible study notes. You're exactly right. Israel, the state of Israel today, I mean, it should be called Nova Khazaria rather than Israel. I think, it's nothing to do with the Old Testament, because if you're a Christian, you actually got to understand that the Old Testament is fulfilled in the New Testament. Everything in the Old Testament looks forward to Jesus being the Messiah and Jesus setting up the spiritual kingdom of Israel and is growing the church. Yes, the church is grafted into the work that God did through the Israelites in the Old Testament, and Jesus is born of the tribe of Judah, and he is the seed, the one person coming from Abraham that is now the blessing to all nations. So if you try to just be an Old Testament only Christian, well, that's basically that's becoming a Judeo-Christian, and then ignore the New Testament, you're going to get into a whole lot of trouble in how you interpret your faith, because you've got to take both together. And you have to realize that all the Old Testament is about Jesus. It's not about the Rothschild state, which is committing a genocide at the moment.
Yeah. You've just very eloquently and subtly corrected me. When I said evangelical Christians, I should have probably said Christian Zionists.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the Christian Zionism is only, seen in the evangelical churches. And so, yeah. I do understand people say this, but to me, it's painful because it gets, people who are true evangelicals, not all evangelicals have taken on board Darby's dispensationalism and Christian Zionism. And in fact, in the younger generations, a lot of people are moving away from that and rejecting it because they can see, well, this 1948 state is not anything to do with God. We need to worship Jesus, not be idolatrous and worship the Jewish people or the state of Israel. In fact, the best way to love Jews is to tell them that they need to repent of their sins and follow Jesus. It's for everybody. That's what our response to Jews should be. You should treat them like everybody else in every other country around the world. The Christian message of Jesus is for everybody, in Greek and Jew, Chinese, Anglo-Saxon, Russian, Arab, everybody. They're not a special people that are going to be ruling the world. That's not of the Bible. So yes, because in going back to your just original point there, Roman Catholics don't have that problem at all. Roman Catholics do not elevate the nation of Israel or the ethnic Jewish people. Neither do the Orthodox churches. They don't even mention it. It's not even an issue for them. It's only in the evangelical churches that have been corrupted by Darby and Scofield and other people that come after them. And it needs to be seen as a heresy and rejected and thrown out so that we can actually get back to, properly, being a Christian, in terms of biblical orthodoxy.
But I mean, at the risk of, people listening to us talking, going, oh, listen to these two guys just talking about Christianity in the Bible. I mean, who cares? It actually does matter, because Netanyahu himself has publicly stated that this is a biblical matter.
Absolutely. And yeah, and again, he's perverting scripture and he's only looking at certain things in the Old Testament and not viewing them through the New Testament and the work of Jesus. And of course, because if you're a Talmudist, you reject Jesus completely. And you know, what he says is the Palestinians are Amalek. They should be totally wiped out. They should be glassed out of existence. That's, you know, that's what happened in the Old Testament when the Israelites went into the Promised Land. You know, they wiped out seven nations living there. And he's saying, well, that happened then. This is what we need to do today. And that's absolutely, absolutely abhorrent. That's, of course, not what you do today. They're human beings. And a lot of Palestinians are Christians. There are more Christian Palestinians than Christian, you know, Israeli Jews. There are some, great, thank God, there are 30,000 Messianic Jews, but there are 300,000 Palestinian Christians, mostly living in the West Bank, because those living in Gaza have just been forced to flee. And the churches that are left have been bombed by the Israeli Defense Force over the last 2 years. So, you know, it's just beyond my understanding. I just find it very hard to understand how evangelical Christians in the United States that do believe this Israel, you know, they are idolize the nation of Israel, cannot see that actually they're harming and bombing and killing Christians. Why are they not supporting their fellow brothers and sisters in Christ who live in Palestine? I just don't understand it. It's either a blind spot or, you know, willful.
It's hatred, it's propaganda, it's indoctrination. Yes, also the thing that I have found to be quite ironic is how many people play with this term anti-Semitic without realizing that a Semite includes Arabs.
Mm. Indeed, the majority of Semites are Arabs. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing
So I'm not anti-Semitic. I've got nothing against Arabs.
No, not at all. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Ashkenazim, the settlers, are actually not Semitic at all. They're Khazarians. They're descendants of Khazarians from
Eastern Europe.
Ukraine. Yeah, Eastern Europe and originally Southern Russia, what's now Southern Russia and Eastern Ukraine. Yeah. But that's why they don't do, they're not allowed to do DNA tests, apparently, in Israel, because they don't want anyone to actually find this out, which is very, very ironic. So I get called anti-Semitic. I say, well, I'm not. I'm for an end to genocide.
It's very interesting, though, the whole stand or support Israel, stand with us thing. And, you know, I think we're going to be having this discussion still 10, 15 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, it's been going on all my lifetime. And, you know, this happened, this started before I was born. And you would love to see a solution to it. The only solution that there is that both sides become Christian. And then they forgive each other in Christ. That's the only solution to all of these things where there's different ethnic groups in the same area that are in conflict with each other. That's the only solution. Otherwise, one side is going to wipe the other out. You know, the Palestinians get accused of singing "From the River to the Sea, Palestine Will Be Free." That's supposedly anti-Semitic hate song. But then the first people to use that were the Zionist settlers who said, "This is our land from the river to the sea, and we're going to settle here." They were the first people to come up with the phrase, and the Palestinians have just taken it on. So, you know, you've got two peoples here who both want the whole land. It was originally the Palestinians' land. They welcomed Jewish settlers in 1946, and then they turned around and started killing them and pushing them out into, you know, these very, very small areas from which they're not allowed to leave. So, you know, the whole thing is horrendous for anyone who lives there. There is a solution. It's Jesus. Will they take it up? I hope so. I pray so, but we shall see.
Dave, politics is generally about populism, and the kind of stuff that you talk about is not popular.
No, I mean, I act out of principle, and that's one of the things I wanted to do when I started the Heritage Party in 2020, is to have principles and to stick to them. And even if they weren't popular, they were one of the first things I came up against a lot of resistance to, was being pro-life and also being pro-traditional marriage. I said, you know, in our manifesto, as well as many other things, you know, we would abolish the Abortion Act, we'd abolish the Same-Sex Marriage Act. And a lot of people said, well, we like everything else, we don't like this thing, we don't like that thing, and unless you drop them, I'm not going to join you, I'm not going to support you. And I'm like, well, this is what we need. You know, we can't be a socially conservative party with Christian principles to try to restore our nation in the way that it needs to be restored if we drop all of our principles. And, you know, as the years have gone on, there's been one thing, another thing, another thing that has come up that I've said, well, this is our position, or this is my position based on principle. And then every time a few people have left and said, we're not going to support you. And it's very sad that, you know, you think that people would think that if you agree with 95% or even 99% of what we stand for, you'd support us. But quite often it's the other way around. People say, there's that one thing I don't like, and I'm not going to support you because of that one thing. But I'm not going to drop these things because we need them. And, you know, if I'm going to drop them and if I'm going to compromise, I might as well not bother. You know, there's no point in bothering. I might as well go and join the fake Conservative Party and, you know, just take the money rather than stand up for what's principled.
Yeah, so what drives you then is principle. I mean, I asked you at the beginning of the conversation, do you wake up with purpose? And obviously you do then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that's why I love it. I love, you know, the fact that now I'm leading a party, I'm in the political sphere, we got lots of candidates, we got lots of people who do support us, who want to restore our nation in the same way and fight the insanity of what we've had over the last 60 years or so. But yeah, that does give me purpose. And you have to, you've got to stand on principle. Otherwise, you know, I just don't understand people who just are populists, if you like. You know, Nigel Farage is a good example of a populist. He will say what's popular, what he thinks will get him the most votes. And so, you know, I like him as a person. I can have a nice drink and a good time with him down the pub. But he'll say one thing one week because he thinks it's popular. And then he realised public opinions change, so he'll say the exact opposite thing. Whether it's on immigration, on welfare, on, you know, other things he's talking about, on net zero. And I think you've got to be consistent. If you're not consistent and you don't stand on principles, you're like someone who stands on the sand and eventually you're just going to fall in.
Okay, so as we're coming for the final lap, if you were to give me a nugget of wisdom, Dave, what would that be?
Goodness me, that's a question to put me on the spot. A nugget of wisdom is just be true to yourself. I think don't worry about what anyone thinks about you or says about you, because they're going to say anyway, whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you think, there will always be people that disagree with you or don't like you. You cannot keep everybody happy. And so if you're not true to yourself, if you're trying to live a life where you're doing it to keep other people happy because you want to try to keep everyone happy because you're worried about their opinions, you're never going to win. You're never going to be able to keep everybody happy. You've got to be true to yourself, search out what the truth is, and be faithful to that, and find your mission, find your purpose, and go for it.
How can my audience follow you?
My party, Heritage Party, is the website is heritageparty.org. And if you're in the UK, the thing that will help me the most in the UK is if you become a member of the Heritage Party, which you can do at heritageparty.org. And all of our manifesto and our principles and policies are on there. On social media, I'm on a lot of platforms, at David Curtin on X, at you know, the same thing, David Curtin 1, I think, on YouTube. YouTube. I'm also on Facebook. I'm on Gab. I'm on Telegram. So you can follow me on all of those platforms. I've even started putting things on TikTok now. There's not much there at the moment, but I will put some more on for the young people on TikTok as well as things go on. So all of those platforms, Twitter, Facebook, sorry, X, Facebook, Gab, Telegram, TikTok, YouTube, Rumble, follow me there.
So funny you said for the young people. I remember the days when we wouldn't have said that for the young people.
I'm in my 50s now. I'm going to be a pensioner soon. It's crazy. I really don't look like it, but it is so bizarre where, you know, it only seems like a few years ago I could say I was young, and now, my gosh, the time has just flown by.
You've got nothing to worry about, David. You don't look a day over 62. So you're good.
Thank you very much. I'll take that as a compliment.
David Curtin, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you.